Hello and welcome to today's program of the Commonwealth Club of California. My name is Kevin O'Malley. I'm chairman of the Business and Leadership Forum here at the club and your host for tonight. Our speaker tonight is Jonah Berger. Our program is Why Things Catch On. I'm going to introduce Jonah right now, give you a short bio about him, and then turn it over to Jonah for the program. Jonah Berger is the James G. Campbell Assistant Professor of Marketing at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. He's published dozens of articles in top-tier academic journals, and popular accounts of his work have appeared in places like the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, Washington Post, Science, Harvard Business Review, Wired, Business Week, and Fast Company. His research has also been featured in the New York Times annual Year in Ideas issue. Berger has been recognized with awards for both scholarship and teaching, including being named Wharton's Iron Prof. He lives in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Let's welcome Jonah Berger, please.
Thank you all for coming today. I'm very excited to be here and speak to you and share with you some of the ideas that we've been developing over the past decade. I hope to make today an engaging session, an interactive one. I've brought some material with me, but it will be most exciting for you if you guys are engaged as well. So feel free to ask any questions at any point, and we can see where the discussion goes. So I'm going to be talking today about why things catch on, and I want to start with a story about a bar in New York City. And so the story starts with a guy named Chris Shabiro. As a young man, he always loved hot dogs. And as he grew up, he decided he wanted to make a great hot dog restaurant. So he traveled around the East Coast doing what he called market research, which basically involved eating every hot dog he could find. He went to every famous hot dog place up and down the East Coast, in New Jersey, in New York, in New England, even in the Philly area, to find the best hot dog. And so after traveling around, he and his partner started a restaurant in New York City called Criff Dogs. Criff Dogs is basically, if you love hot dogs, Criff Dog is the place to die for. So it has every hot dog you can imagine, everything from a good morning hot dog with bacon, eggs, and cheese, a little bit rough on a morning stomach, but maybe tasty. They have a hot dog with pineapple and green onions, and they also have a traditional New York-style water dog. Delicious set of hot dogs on the menu. So he owned Criff Dogs for about a decade. It did quite well. And then the space next door to him opened. It had been a bubble tea lounge, hadn't done so well. And Chris had always wanted to open a bar. He thought, wouldn't it be neat if we could open a bar next door to this hot dog restaurant? Now, as you know, if you've ever been to New York, there are thousands of bars in New York, dozens within a couple blocks of Chris's establishment. And so one question is, how could he make this small new bar catch on and become popular? So Chris thought about it for a while. He had a number of different ideas. He had different styles what he was going to do with it. Originally wanted to be a sort of old-style rock and roll bar, he thought originally, and he scrapped that and came up with something else. Then one day he had a friend who was an antique dealer, and the friend came across an old phone booth. And probably folks in the audience, some of you may remember what a phone booth is. Imagine what Clark Kent would go into to change into Superman. So an old-style phone booth. And so he found this phone booth, and Chris had an amazing idea for his bar. So he actually decided to do something different with his bar than most people usually would. He actually took that telephone booth and he put it in the wall, just like this. And rather than advertising his bar, he's never advertised, yet it's extremely successful now. Now it's about 5 or 6 years old. If you call and try to get in, reservations open around 3 p.m. every day. People frantically hit redial again and again to get through. By 3:30, all the seats for that night are gone. Yet he's never advertised. So what's he doing right? Was it his cute little phone booth or was it something else? Let me tell you how getting into this bar works, and maybe you'll have a little bit of an idea. So imagine you're sitting in this hot dog restaurant, and you decide to check that phone booth out. So you walk inside, and on the wall will be an old-school rotary dial phone. And this goes even further back than the phone booth. So a couple of folks in the audience may remember what a rotary dial phone is. The younger folks may never have seen one. But imagine a phone you have to stick your finger into and go around in a circle to dial a number. So just for kicks, stick your finger in the number 2, go around in a circle, if you're standing inside this phone booth, and put the receiver up to your ear. Ring, ring. Someone will pick up the other line, and they'll ask whether you have a reservation. A reservation? I'm standing in a phone booth inside of a hot dog restaurant. What would I have a reservation for? But if you have a reservation, or there happens to be space, the back of this door, this phone booth, will open, and you'll be led into a secret bar called Please Don't Tell. Now, Please Don't Tell has violated a number of traditional laws of marketing, right? There's actually no sign on the street. The only way you can get into this bar is through this phone booth. No sign on the street, no sign even inside the hot dog restaurant. If you're sitting there munching on your hot dog, you'll notice a whole bunch of people go into the phone booth and never come out. It's sort of like the Bermuda Triangle of phone booths. So they don't come out, and after a while you start to wonder, but there's no sign in the bar. They've done everything they can to make themselves a secret. But if you think about a secret for a moment, there's actually something sort of funny about a secret. Think about the last time someone told you a secret. They told you not to tell another soul. Keep it all to yourself. What'd you do next with that information? Probably told someone else, right? Don't worry, your secret is safe with me. And the idea here is that when we know secrets, we want to share them with other people because it makes us look special. Chris built this bar. He's never advertised it. It's been extremely successful because he figured out what makes things catch on. It's not advertising. It's not necessarily the quality. It's a good bar. People ask me, is it the best bar I've ever been to? It's not the best bar ever. But he figured out how to harness the science of word of mouth and social influence. And so that's what I'm going to talk about today. You might have seen things catch on, things become popular. And you might have wondered, why is Greek yogurt the newest, biggest thing at the grocery store? Why is kale or bacon the biggest ingredient at every restaurant in town? Or lobster macaroni and cheese? We can't seem to get enough of lobster macaroni and cheese. Why do these things happen? And not just in food, right? In books, in culture. There are viral videos. Now it was the Harlem Shake everybody's doing. A couple months ago it was Gangnam Style. A few years ago it was Rebecca Black. These things come and go, but what makes them happen? And what I'm going to talk about today is that it's not luck, and it's not chance, and it's not random. There's actually a science behind why these things catch on and become popular. And so that's what I'm going to talk about today. So just to get us a little bit of participation, get the wheels going a little bit, I want to ask you a question. Here are three products or brands you might be familiar with. We have Walt Disney World, the self-described place where dreams come true. We have Honey Nut Cheerios, the delicious breakfast cereal, which they say will lower your cholesterol. Whether or not that's true, I don't know. And Scrubbing Bubbles, some of us may be overly familiar with this product. It's a bathroom cleaner, basically like a 409 or a Fantastic. So if you had to guess, which of these three products do you think gets the most word of mouth? What would you guess? Which of these three do people talk about the most? And if someone could give me a hand. Okay, somebody said Disney there in the back. Good. How many people want to go with Disney? Take a vote, a straw poll. Okay, wow, most everybody. All right. Somebody have a different guess? Yeah. Scrubbing Bubbles. How many people want to go with Scrubbing Bubbles? Okay, wow. And I heard Cheerios in the back. How many people want to go with Cheerios? A couple brave souls. Okay, good. So I want to point out two things here. First of all, we're not really sure. You all looked at me very quizzically, actually, for a moment, like, I don't know the answer to that question. What would the answer to the question be? And then you thought about it. So it's a hard question to answer. Then you thought about it. So how many people guessed Disney World, by the way? Great answer. Great guess. Unfortunately, it's wrong. Scrubbing Bubbles? That sounds better, right? Also an excellent guess. Also wrong. Of these three things, Cheerios gets the most word of mouth. It was the one that most of us didn't. A couple brave souls raised their hand. About 40% went with Disney. About maybe 50% went with Scrubbing Bubbles. About 10% went with Cheerios. If we had to guess, we got it wrong. And so I don't think we really understand why people talk about some things rather than others. And so that's the science I'm going to talk about today. Yes, question. Good. You guys are getting into it right away. Don't stop. Go for it.
So when you started, we were talking about advertising not being the thing, right?
Yes.
And so the reason I thought of Scrubbing Bubbles was because you don't really see a lot of advertisement for it, yet it sells really well and everyone kind of uses it.
Yes.
And it just kind of happens, like when you get a house and you buy cleaning products, it's just there.
They just show up.
It just shows up. But Honey Nut Cheerios advertises a lot.
Yes. Yes. And we'll talk about it in a second why. I'm going to hold the why for a second if you don't mind. But we'll talk about why, right? We think it's Disney. I've done this now about 24 times. People almost always guess Disney. It seems like it should be Disney, right? And it's not. And we'll talk about why in a second. So in case this isn't clear already, word of mouth is really important in driving behavior. You might think that advertising is what drives sales, but word of mouth actually has twice the impact of advertising in categories as diverse as skincare and mobile phones. Researchers recently have shown everything from Amazon reviews, so an extra 5-star review on Amazon leads to about 20 more books sold. In offline space, if we think about face-to-face communication, word of mouth about a restaurant by a first-time customer can actually lead to about a $200 increase in sales for that restaurant. And so from online behavior to offline behavior, from technology products to consumer packaged goods to even B2B services, actually 91% of B2B sales are driven by word of mouth. Word of mouth is much more effective than advertising. Any ideas why? And if maybe I'll hand the mic so we make sure this actually works. I'm not supposed to do this, but go ahead.
Word of mouth seems much more trusted as a source of information because it's perceived to be organic.
Yeah.
And frequently could come from a trusted friend or other source who already has some reputation with you.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And so that idea of trust, thanks. That idea of trust is really important. We've all seen that ad that says 9 out of 10 dentists prefer this toothpaste, right? Do we believe that ad? Not so much, right? We want to know who those dentists are. We've never met them before. You never see the ad that says 1 out of 10 dentists like this toothpaste, right? 5 out of 10 say it's the worst thing they've ever seen. The other 4 think it'll rot your gums. You never see that ad. And so because of that, right, because we know they're trying to sell us something, we don't necessarily believe what they're saying. But we believe our friends. Our friends will tell us if a product's good, but they'll also tell us if that product is terrible. They'll be honest with us. They have our best interests at heart. So one reason word of mouth is much more effective is that trust idea. The second is a little more nuanced, and that's the targeting benefit of word of mouth. So often advertising tries to find a target market. If you're selling skis, for example, you try to find the customers that will be most interested in that. Maybe you advertise in a ski magazine. But lots of people who read that magazine might not actually be in the market for the product at the moment, right? You spend a bunch of money advertising to people that aren't really listening, right? So your advertising dollars were a little bit of a waste. Whereas word of mouth tends to be really, really targeted. If you don't have a baby, no one's going to come up to you and tell you about a great place to buy baby clothes. If you don't like spicy food, no one's going to tell you about a fantastic new spicy restaurant in town because they know that's not something you're interested in. And so word of mouth is like a searchlight. Goes through your social network to find the people that are most interested in that information, right? You tell movies, if you like horror movies, you only talk about it to other people that like that sort of thing. And so a great example of this targeting benefit actually happened to me a couple years ago, and it involved a book. So professors often get sent book in the mail from publishers who want us to assign them in our classes to all the students, so they get them. And so sometimes they get books, and I put them on a shelf, and I don't always read them because they're not always fantastic. But this time they did something different. They sent me 2 copies of the same book. Now, let me tell you, that book was not any better reading it a second copy. It was equally good the first time and the second time, right? It's not any different. So why did they do it? They sent a little note, and they said, hey, Professor Berger, we think you'll like this book, and we think you'll know someone else who would like it too. And so please give this to someone else that would like it as well. And that's the targeting benefit of word of mouth, right? We tend to be friends with other people that are like us. They're not identical to us, but if we're really into football, they tend to like football. If we love opera, they tend to like opera. If they come to the Commonwealth Club, we probably go as well, right? We have things in common. And so if you like a product or service, you'll likely know other people that like the same product or service. So that's word of mouth and why it's effective. You might think that word of mouth, right? We've heard a lot about Facebook and Twitter being the really important things that drive word of mouth, social media. If you had to guess, what percent of word of mouth do you think is online? On things like Facebook and Twitter and social media sites, on blogs, for example, on online reviews, compared to offline, which would be face-to-face communication or the phone. If you had to guess a number, percentage, what would you go with? Yeah? 33%? Okay. Somebody else?
Outbound or
all the percent of word of mouth that happens on a daily basis that's online. So it would be either direction. So it's actually not my metric. It's a company called the Keller Fay Group. They're the Nielsen of word of mouth. They give people diaries and ask them to record what they talk about throughout the day, and they ask them to record what channel they talk about it over. So I heard 33%. I want to take a couple more guesses. We'll play the Price is Right.
I'm saying 5% or 95%.
Now that's cheating. You don't get to get both sides, right? Yeah. 60%? Okay, I feel like an auctioneer here. Do I hear 70? 70? Yeah. 17? So it's actually closer to 17. It's actually 7. I'm having trouble here holding up 7 because I got the microphone. So you sort of split your bet there. We think it's really big because we hear so much about Facebook and Twitter, right? We hear so much about these technologies, and there's a record of what we shared on those technologies because we can see it. We can go back and look at that tweet we shared or that Facebook status update or that information we shared online. But think about if you came here with a friend, what'd you do in the 10 minutes while you were waiting for this to start or while you walked over? What did you do today at work when you were having lunch with your colleagues or breakfast with your family or when you have drinks after this talk with your friends? You talk face-to-face. And so much more word of mouth actually happens in a face-to-face or offline context. And the second problem with focusing so much on social media and online is we think a lot about the technology. So does everyone remember MySpace? It's really popular probably about 5 years ago now. So 5 years ago, you might have thought that MySpace was where all the word of mouth happened. And you might have thought exactly about why word of mouth happens on MySpace. And now, nobody thinks about MySpace anymore. Apologies if any of you work for MySpace or still love MySpace. It's not as popular as it used to be. And so rather than focusing so much on the technology, we need to think more about the psychology. Bless you. Why people talk about and share things, regardless if they're talking online or offline. And so this is the part in the talk where I put up a picture of a cat. And you might wonder what this cat's doing. It's a little bit hard to see. This is essentially a cat DJ. If you've never seen a cat DJ before, this is what a cat DJ would look like. So it's got a little turntable. It's not actually a turntable. It's like a scratching post. But you can imagine the cat with a little thing in its ear going, doing whatever a cat might do. This is not my cat. It's a picture off the web. Does anyone have any idea why I put a picture of a cat in a talk about viral content online? Because cats are viral, right? There's a theory out there that cats are the reason people talk about and share things. Oh, it's all about cats. If you haven't heard this theory, check online. It's like the second thing that comes up. Hopefully my book will be the first thing in a couple months. But right now, the first six are like, well, it's cats. And then it must be cats. And it's probably cats. And then someone's like, no, it's dogs. And then they say it's cats again. So people think it's all about cats. And there are two problems with this theory. First, it's like saying Bill Clinton, Bill Cosby, and Bill Gates are all famous, and they're all named Bill. So if you name your child Bill, your child will be famous. Right? It's patently false. It's confusing correlation and causation. Yes, there are some cat things, maybe this one, that's highly shared, but there are a lot of cat things that aren't shared. And so by only looking at the successes, we don't figure out the failures. And the second problem is, while that might be useful for explaining cat stuff, it doesn't tell us about anything else. And so rather than thinking about cats, oh, there's my clicker. I kept going back to that. Good. I'm going to put an X over this pretty kitty. I'm sorry. And instead, we're going to talk about science, right? The science of social transmission, of talk and conversations. We've done things like looked at over 7,000 New York Times articles. Every article written by the Times over a six-month period. And controlling for where it was featured and how famous the person who wrote it was. What about the content itself made people want to share it? What about the emotions it evoked? If it evoked anger or sadness or anxiety? What about the utility of the information it provided and how that affected what people share? We've looked at products and brands, all sorts of different content to understand the drivers of social transmission, why people talk about and share some things rather than others. So I'm going to suggest today that there's a recipe to make things more viral or talkable, and we can craft contagious content. We can build messages or ideas that people are going to share. And I'm going to focus more on the message than the messenger. So you might have thought that people are really important. Certain special people make things go viral, right? If you get those influentials or those opinion leaders or those mavens, connectors, and salesmen, you can just get them your product or idea. It'll be really popular. But there's actually no data supporting that theory. It's a great story. There's no real data to back it up. And so rather than focusing so much on the messenger, we're going to think about the message. What messages do people want to pass along and share? So today I'm going to talk about six key steps. These are also in the book if you're interested. I don't think we have time to go through all of them, but I'll talk about some of these ideas that we've found again and again drive people to talk and share. We saw the same principles at work. It's almost like a recipe. Certain ingredients make that recipe better. And so we'll talk about how things like social currency and emotion and public information make people talk and share. And again, if you have any questions, feel free to stick a hand up and we'll grab them. So social currency relates to that idea I started with, right? That idea of please don't tell. Imagine you went to that bar. Think about how you would feel after you left that bar. You would want to tell everyone else that story because it's so entertaining that you went. But along the way, it does something special. It makes you look good. To have been at a place like that, right, to talk about it and be able to know about it, it makes you look special and in the know. And so social currency is all about status by association. We talk about things that make us look special and smart and funny rather than behind the times and not like an insider. And by the way, if you think this doesn't apply to you, that's okay. Look around the room. I'm sure you think it applies to other people. And I'm sure they're actually looking around and looking at you and thinking it applies to you. And so this is one of those great things in psychology where we never think it's us. It is us too. We do this same sort of thing. We think we're alone in a crowd of sheep. We're the only one that's not influenced by others' behavior, but we actually are quite susceptible as well. So play a game with me for a second. My friend Carla drives a minivan. I want to see how much you can guess about her based solely on the fact that she drives a minivan. So if you had to guess, how old do you think she is? 35. So let's see, how many people think between 35 and 45? Okay, noted for the recording, almost everybody. Does she have kids? Yes. Do they play sports?
Yes.
What sport do they play?
Soccer.
Someone give you a cheat sheet when you walked in for all my questions so you know we were going to ask? We could do the same thing with a guy with a mohawk, right? We would make certain inferences about him based on his choices. It's not like he couldn't shop at the Gap. It's not like J. Crew or Banana Republic would bar the door if he went in to buy chinos, right? He could shop wherever he wanted. He could listen to classical music if he wanted. But we make inferences about him because choices communicate identity. Choices communicate information about us, about people. We make inferences about others. We do the same thing about what they say. Someone talks a lot about food, we assume they're into food and they're a foodie. They talk a lot about technology, we assume they're into that space. They're always talking about golf and other sports, well, we assume that they're a sportsman or woman, right? And so what people talk about affects how people see them, so we talk about things that make us look good rather than bad. So let me give you two more examples of this and how this works. One is making people feel like insiders. And this is what Please Don't Tell does really well. If you notice, they applied scarcity and exclusivity to make that experience feel really unique. And you might think that's unique or special to a hidden bar. People couldn't do that with other things. Is everyone familiar with the McRib? Let me tell you the story behind the McRib. So the McRib was invented by McDonald's. It's a popular McDonald's sandwich nowadays. It was invented because McDonald's had Chicken McNuggets. Chicken McNuggets were selling out the door. Right? They were fantastic. And they needed to figure out something else to have in their restaurant to get some people away from McNuggets when they couldn't have enough chicken. It's amazing. McDonald's actually ran out of chicken, but they did. So their chef, Rene Arnault, was sort of into Cajun sort of flavors. He was into a little bit of stuff from down south. And so he came up with this sandwich called the McRib, which is a little bit of a misnomer because there's actually no rib meat in the McRib. It's essentially a lot of barbecue sauce wrapped around some pork shoulder and sort of stomach meat and other less desirable cuts of beef or pork. But it's shaped in the size of like ribs. So if you look at it, it looks like ribs, which is at least a little bit more concerning when you're eating this thing. I talked about this earlier today, by the way, and I said that the McRib was not delicious, and somebody protested very loudly that the McRib was a fantastic sandwich. So if you like the McRib, that's okay. But here's the interesting thing. So McDonald's introduces the McRib, and sales do okay, but not great. So then they do something interesting. They actually take the McRib off the market. And then they only introduce it in certain stores at certain times of year, and then they take it away. And what they found is by making it scarce, it's only there for a limited time, suddenly everyone wants the McRib. When it comes into town, everyone's like, oh my God, the McRib is here. We have to go get it. People have built an online website called the McRib Locator, which actually has little dots for where the McRib is at the moment, what cities it's available in, for a sandwich that's not even real rib meat. You may have noticed if you've ever been to In-N-Out, everyone, In-N-Out fans in the room? Yeah. So In-N-Out seems like it has a really simple menu, right? Only four or five things. The hamburger, cheeseburger, fries, a milkshake. But they actually have a secret menu. Right? People can go in and they can order a 2x2 or a 4x4 or a Flying Dutchman. And why do people order these things? Well, it makes them seem in the know. It makes them seem like an insider, which would seem interesting until you think that they're an insider for a fast food restaurant. Yet it's a little bit like being a VIP, right? You can go in and order something that's not on the menu and your friends will look at you like, wow, you must come here often. They must know what you like. And so this idea of making people feel like an insider is universal. Disney uses the same thing when they release their movies, right? It's only out of the vault for this month. Or Cinderella, get it before it goes back in the vault to get us fired up and activated to go buy it and also to talk about it and share it. So that's making people feel like insiders. One other way to apply this idea of social currency is to find the inner remarkability in any product or idea. And so you might think that only certain products are naturally remarkable. And by remarkable, I mean surprising, novel, or interesting. So, for example, a hidden bar is pretty novel and interesting, pretty surprising. You might think Apple, for example, makes really remarkable products, or Hollywood movies are really remarkable. But what's a product that you would say is not at all remarkable? It's very mundane. Peanut butter. What else? Trash can. What about household appliances, for example, like a dishwasher, right? Or maybe a blender. Who would talk about a blender? Well, let me show you an example of a company that figured out how to get 100 million views for a blender.
Will it blend? That is the question. I love my new iPhone. It does everything. But will it blend? That is the question. Let's find out. I think I'm going to push the smoothie button.
Mm-hmm.
looking for their phone to make sure it's safe.
I smoke. Don't breathe this. Now, you fans on YouTube have asked me to blend an iPhone. So I did it. But I have another. I'm going to put this on eBay.
A little bit remarkable? How many people thought that was a little bit? At least a little bit. For a blender, right? Let me tell you the story about how Will It Blend happened. So this company is BlendTech. They're out of Utah. They hired a new marketing guy. His name was George Wright. On his first day in the office, he walks in and he notices a pile of sawdust sitting on the floor of the office. And he looks at it and goes, sawdust? We're in the office. Where would this be from? And so he asks his colleagues, hey, you know, are we remodeling? What's going on with the office? And so his colleague says, no, the CEO is actually doing what he does every day. Try to break blenders. So CEO would take 2x4 pieces of wood, marbles, golf balls, Bic lighters, anything he could find, chuck them in the blender, and see if the blender was tough enough to cut it. He wanted to make a really strong blender. And so the marketing guy saw, I said, this is genius. So he took a $50 budget, not $50 million, not $50,000, but $50 budget, and filmed his CEO. You guys laughed at that poor guy, right? That's the CEO of the company. He's not an actor. You wonder why he's goofy? He's the actual CEO. And they filmed him doing what the CEO was already doing, trying to break blenders. And they put it online, and this video got thousands upon thousands upon eventually millions of videos. This particular video has over 10 million at the moment. Now the set has over 100 million. And it got people to be excited about something that's one of the most mundane products in the world, a blender. And so this is the idea of inner remarkability. If we think about what makes any product surprising or interesting, we're going to be more likely to get people to talk about it. A couple months ago, I actually got people at my house at a party, a bunch of people over, and I got toilet paper to be one of the most discussed products at my party. Do you want to know how I did it? I put a roll of black toilet paper in the bathroom. Now, if you've never seen black toilet paper before, I will guarantee the first time you see black toilet paper, you will be amazed and you will tell someone else. Because you've never seen colored toilet paper before. The first time I saw it, I was like, this is amazing. And you have to tell someone else. And so even though it's toilet paper, seems like a really boring product, by finding that inner remarkability, people are going to talk about it and share it. So that's the idea of social currency. And getting to the next dimension, I want to talk a little about triggers. And social currency is sort of a sexy, fun topic. Triggers are a little bit more boring, but they're equally important. So here I want to use another example. Are you guys familiar with Rebecca Black? A couple people? Okay. So Rebecca Black was a 16-year-old girl at the time. Her parents paid about $4,000 to a company called Arc Music Factory to make a song for her. And this song is not the greatest song ever. Let me play it for you for 1 second in case. And I'll only play a short bit, so if you hate the song, you don't have to listen much. Gotta get down to the bus stop. Gotta catch my bus. I see my friends kicking in the front seat, sitting in the back seat. Gotta make my mind up. Okay, so to some of you in the audience, this may sound terrible. In fact, to most of you, it may sound terrible. And indeed, many people have argued that this is the worst song ever. Which in itself is an accomplishment. If you think about it, if you could really make the worst song ever, that would be pretty impressive. Yet this song is so bad, and you wonder why it's bad. It's basically about a teenage girl. She's dealing with those big teenage dilemmas like getting up in the morning, like going to school, like whether to sit in the front seat or the back seat of her friend's car, big, hefty stuff. So if this video is so bad, why did over 300 million people watch it a couple of years ago? Right? One of the most viral videos of 2011. And so you might wonder, well, if it's so terrible, why are so many people sharing it with others? What about it made people share it? So a few years ago, I was teaching an executive education program, and someone in an audience just like this raised their hand, and they said, Professor Berger, look, I like your framework, and it's fine, but if it can't explain Rebecca Black, it's not any good. That was a hot video at the time. They said, look, they put it on the line. If you can explain Rebecca Black, I'll believe you. If not, I'm not going to believe you. And actually, someone in the back of the room stood up. They raised their hand. They said, I think I know why your framework explains Rebecca Black. So they shared this data with me. This is the number of searches for the word Rebecca Black over time. And if you look at this, what you see is that it starts out basically flat. Not a lot of people are interested in it. Spikes up, lots of attention. Then it goes down. Then it comes back up again. Then it goes down. Then it comes back up again, and it goes down. If you look closely at the data, you notice something's going on. Those peaks, those spikes, they're not random. They actually happen every 7 days. Every Friday. Her song is called Friday. So this song is equally bad every day of the week. I've checked. I've listened to it on Monday. I've listened to it on Tuesday. I listened Wednesday, Thursday. I'm a scientist. This is what we do. I've listened to it on Friday. It's equally bad every day of the week. But Friday is in a reminder in the environment to make us think about it and to make us go view it and talk about it and share it with others. And that's what I'll call a trigger. A cue in the environment, a stimulus in the environment that reminds us of something else and gets us to act on it. And so if something is top of mind, it's going to be tip of tongue. Right? We talk about so many things, not because it's the most interesting thing always, but we're trying to fill conversational space. We want to have something to say, and that's why we talk about the weather, for example. Or what are you doing this weekend? Because it's top of mind, it's going to be tip of tongue. So let me give you a couple more examples of that. And a couple folks at the beginning said, hold on, I don't believe this guy's talking. Disney World gets more word of mouth than Cheerios. Think about Disney World, though. How many people have been to Disney World in the audience this year? This year. Okay? Only one or two, right? When you go to Disney World and you come back, let me tell you, you talk about it a lot, right? You talk about, oh, we went on Space Mountain and we saw Cinderella and we ate the big turkey legs and the kids had so much fun and it was great. And you talk about it for about 3 or 4 days and then you go on with the rest of your life and you never mention it again. Disney World is really exciting, but there's nothing in the environment to remind us of it. Cheerios is really boring, super boring. But this is actually the Twitter traffic for Cheerios across the day, the number of mentions of Cheerios over time. And what you see is midnight all the way through the day till the nighttime again. And you notice two things. One, people talk about Cheerios a lot in the morning. And two, sort of cute, you notice it shifted to the right on the weekend. We wake up later on the weekend, we talk about Cheerios later. And so using the product is one thing that makes it top of mind and makes us more likely to talk about it. Even though it's boring because we're eating it, we're talking about it. Even if you don't eat Cheerios, you still wheel that grocery cart through the aisle once every couple of weeks or every week looking for a breakfast cereal, and so you're more likely to have it top of mind. But it's not only usage that makes things top of mind. So do related cues. So if I said peanut butter and jelly, or if I said rum and Coke, peanut butter's like a little advertisement for jelly. The word jelly's not up here, but as soon as you think peanut butter, you also think jelly. As soon as you think rum, you think Coke. As soon as you think cats, you think dogs. Because those things are connected in our mind. One is a trigger for another. And so just like Friday is a trigger for Rebecca Black, even though we could think about whatever we wanted on Friday, other things make products top of mind. That's why Michelob had an old slogan called Weekends Are Made for Michelob. Some of the folks in the audience might remember this slogan, but they did this because they wanted people to think about the beer on the weekend. It's why if you've ever been on a beach vacation, you have a really hard time not ordering a Corona. Right? Corona owns the beach. They want every time you think of the beach, you think of Corona. They want those two things to be paired in your mind. They want them to be connected. And so lots of research has looked into this. So there's been some interesting work, for example, that if they're playing French music in a grocery store, people are more likely to buy French wine. And if they're playing German music, people are more likely to buy German wine. Because those things that are top of mind are affecting our behavior. We actually did an interesting study a couple years ago. So where did someone vote the last time they voted? Where did you vote? School? Somebody else? Fire station? So we vote at different types of locations. We're assigned to where we vote. And you might think that that has no effect on your behavior, right? Why should that affect how you end up voting? You should have your preference in mind. You go and you cast that ballot. We actually found that where people vote can affect how they vote. People voted at schools, for example. We looked at this in the 2000 general election in Arizona. People voted at schools. It actually made them 2% more likely to support a school funding initiative. Even controlling for where they live and whether they have things like kids and other things like that, merely voting at that type of location changed their behavior. Because it changed what was top of mind, right? It made school-related issues seem more important, seem more weighty. You could imagine voting at church, for example, might affect how you feel on gay marriage or stem cell issues. Because these cues in the environment, these stimuli, affect what's top of mind and can affect our behavior. So two interesting things to think about this. First, think about considering that context. What environmental cues are around? What triggers around different consumer environments? If you have a cat and that cat is hungry, what sound might that cat make? Meow, right? Which is why Meow Mix is a great name for cat food. Your cat basically asks for it every time it's hungry. They can't say mix. They're working on saying mix. They're trying to figure it out, but those cats, they're crafty. They'll get there. But they can say meow, and it makes you think of that particular brand. In Philly, for example, there's a great restaurant called Barclay Prime. They have a $100 cheesesteak. And you might say, hold on, $100 for a cheesesteak? Who would pay that much for a cheesesteak? Well, it has Kobe beef. It has lobster on it. It has truffles. It comes with a little bottle of champagne. It's the most opulent cheesesteak you've ever had in your entire life. Very remarkable. But think about why it's particularly good in driving word of mouth for a brand in Philadelphia. When you think of Philly, what do you think of? Cheesesteaks. Lots of cheesesteak places in Philly. I've lived there now for 6 years. You can't go a block or two without seeing a cheesesteak, which makes that story of the $100 cheesesteak more top of mind. Whereas in San Francisco, it wouldn't be as good of a fit because the cues, the context is different. So one thing is to think about a context. And the next is to think about growing a habitat or tying a product to more cues. So a few years ago, Kit Kat, everyone probably knows Kit Kat, right? Delicious chocolate, one of my favorites. It's a brand in the Hershey suite. There are dozens of brands at Hershey's. Kit Kat sort of got lost. No one was buying it, and they needed to figure out how to revitalize the brand. So they started this very simple campaign called Kit Kat and Coffee. Thinking about having a coffee break? Think about a Kit Kat. Having a break with coffee? Have a Kit Kat along with it. Why is coffee a particularly good trigger for Kit Kat? Because people drink it frequently. Right? It's frequent in the environment. And so more frequent cues are better than less frequent cues because you're going to think about related products and ideas more frequently. It would be like the opposite. If Rebecca Black came out with a song called Leap Day, Leap Day, Leap Day, something, something, Leap Day. If you buy me a drink afterwards, I'll do karaoke, I promise. It would be equally good or bad, depending on your preference, right? But it wouldn't be thought of very often because Leap Day doesn't happen very frequently. That slogan, weekends are made for Michelob, it actually started out as holidays are made for Michelob. But they changed it to weekends because weekends are more frequent, because they wanted people to think about the brand more often. So that's triggers. I'm going to skip emotion in the interest of time. It's fun, but if you want to read all about it, we look at how different emotions drive sharing. Actually, some emotions increase sharing, but some decrease sharing. And I'll leave you, it's not positive and negative, it's actually more complicated than that. I'll let you read about it in the book. And what, we end at 30 after? 30 after? I'll talk about public for a second since we're in the Apple neck of the woods. So Apple's known for making products that are at least easy to use by their customers. From the Steve Jobs book, we've all learned that Steve Jobs was not a very nice guy. He didn't care about his customers. But they did care about their customers and making the product easy to use. You think about that first time you took the iPhone out of the box and you remember looking for the instructions. Where are the instructions? How am I going to use this thing? And then you just turn it on and it's really easy to use. So they just want their products to be simple and easy to use for customers. So a few years ago, they had an issue with a laptop. This is their laptop at the time. And whenever you take a laptop out of your bag, you have to figure out which side should face you. Because you want the side with the clip to face you. Otherwise, you got to turn it around, and it's a big, annoying pain. So they used the logo like a compass. Set that laptop down on the table. The logo's facing you. If you can see it, that's the right side. Facing up towards you, it's fantastic. But then they noticed that there was a little problem with that. And that's if the logo's facing you when the product is closed, it's actually upside down for everyone else when the product is open. And so they actually made the product harder for the customer to use, right? If you've ever seen yourself taking the face in the laptop the wrong way and turning it around, this is why. But because they wanted to make it easier for everyone else to see what you're using. You already know what type of product you're using. You bought it. But they want it to be more observable for others. Because if things are more observable, they're easier to imitate. If something is built to show, other people can see it, it's built to grow. And so there's this idea in psychology of social proof. We're all familiar with this idea. Imagine you're in a city you don't know very well, and you're trying to figure out where to go for dinner. So you're going to decide you're going to walk up and down the street, and you're going to find a place. How do you pick which place to go to? Most crowded. Why? That's social proof. We use others as proof about what things are good. So should I carry an umbrella with me or not today? I don't know. Let me look outside and see if other people are carrying an umbrella. For me, this example always happens in San Francisco with a jacket. I'm flying in from the East Coast, for example, and I'm trying to figure out, do I need my big East Coast jacket or not? And I look outside. San Francisco can easily be, you know, 50 in the summer and 80 in the winter. I never know. So I look to other people to help me solve that problem. If you've ever been at a fancy dinner and you're sitting there going, which of those two forks is the right fork to eat with the salad? Same thing, right? We look around for others because we think others have information about the right thing to do. But notice you can only imitate others if you can see what they're doing. You can look around someone else and see their dress or their shirt, and you can imitate it, but it's much harder to imitate their socks because you can't see them. And so one reason things catch on is because they're more publicly observable. The easier for something is to see, for people to see what others are doing, the easier it is to imitate. So one thing that marketers do to help products catch on is then design products to advertise themselves, to make it easier for people to see when someone is using it. And so the most simple example of this is logos. Has everyone noticed the new Polo logo? How it's larger than it used to be? So I'm a scientist, so we do things like measure logos. So we went out, we took a tape measure, and we measured the height and the width of the logo. We found that it got 18 times larger than it used to be. The Lacoste logo, everyone know the alligator, has also gotten larger. Looks like it's about to bite off the arm of anyone who's wearing a large alligator, big croc shirt. But as you might imagine, some people don't like large logos, right? So are logos the only way to make products more observable, make them easier to advertise themselves? And no, right? There are other ways to do it as well. So Apple did this again very cleverly with their headphones. So you may remember portable CD players. Remember you had to run, you held them like a pizza, you had to run like this to make sure they didn't skip. And then they come out with a new product. It's called the MP3 player. But you have to decide, is this new thing, is this new technology worth adopting? Is it going to be good or not? How do I know? And how do I know which of these competing players I should buy? There was a Rio player and a Microsoft player and an Apple player. And if I don't know if it's any good, is it worth plunking down $300 to get it? So if you're looking around and you see everybody wearing black headphones, you have no idea which product they're using. But if solely on the subway or on the bus or on your way to work or at the office, you notice one person with white headphones, and then you notice another person with white headphones, eventually you're going to ask, well, what are those headphones for? And you're going to assume that if lots of people have it, it must be good. And so it helped Apple's product catch on because it was easier to see. Yeah.
Did they patent the color?
They did not patent the white headphones, no. And there's actually been, some of the audience may know this, there's Christian Louboutin shoes with the red bottoms. You may be aware that there was some patent case with them, right, about saying they're known, so it's, again, a subtle signal. It's a brand of women's shoes. I didn't bring a picture with me, but some of you who know fashion will know. If you ever see a woman walking around with shoes that have red bottoms, they're from this brand, and you might say, well, why would you put a color on the bottom of your shoes? But it's actually a subtle signal. It's for those who are in the know can recognize it, right? It's sort of a code almost a way. It's called dog whistle fashion. It's sort of like you're speaking in code to other people that are in the know. It's true of men's fashion as well. So sometimes you'll see colors on the underside of collars, for example, or a particular stitching as a way of signaling. So they have not patented those colors. But color is definitely a way to communicate it. If anyone's noticed, there's a company in San Francisco called Lyft. I don't know if anyone knows Lyft, but they're basically taxi cabs, people acting as taxi cabs. But the problem is, how do you know who's one of these cabs? So they put a pink mustache, a big fluffy pink mustache, on the front of all the cars, making it easier for people to see which car is actually engaged in this service. And this is really important, actually, if you think about nonprofits. So if any of you are in the nonprofit space, there's a big problem, right? How does people have any idea what causes other people donate to? They don't. It's a really private behavior. It's not very observable. How can you make it more public? And so one organization had a really smart idea. They started a campaign called Movember. And the idea of Movember is very simple. So rather than sponsoring someone to run a 5K, for the month of November, you can sponsor them to grow a mustache. They already have a mustache. You can't really sponsor them. But you can grow your someone to sponsor them to have grow a mustache. But what's interesting about this is it makes it public that someone's engaging in this cause. Right now, when you walk into the office and you see some guy who you thought was a buttoned-up Wall Street type sporting a Raleigh Fingers mustache with the things curled at the end, you're going to ask that guy, what are you doing? What's with the mustache? And he'll tell you. And now the public, the private has become public. It's easier to tell what other people are doing. And so that spread amazingly well. Now it's in over 30 different countries, and they've raised, I think, over $750 million for this cause by figuring out how to make the private, that act of donation, more publicly visible, more observable to others. Okay, so I'm going to skip practical value in the interest of time. If you want to read about this guy, his name is Ken Craig. He's made a viral video. It's about corn. If you think no one could make a viral video about corn, read about it. It's in the book. He's 86 years old, an interesting guy. I called him up. I said, hi, I'm here to interview you from the Wharton School. He said, I don't want any. He hung up the phone. So either he's smarter than I think he is, or he thought I was a telemarketer. I had to call him back and interview him. But you can read about the interview in the book. Last but not least, I want to talk about stories. So is everyone familiar with the story of the Trojan horse? This idea, so it's a battle of the Greeks versus the Trojans, sort of the first reality show. Someone steals someone's wife. They have a fight about it. So it's an epic poem told for generations and generations. But like many old stories, it has a moral. You might remember that the moral of this story is beware of Greeks bearing gifts. Beware of people who are being nice to you, particularly when they're your enemies, right? Be careful. And if you think about it, most stories are actually like Trojan horses. They have a moral or an information or something else hidden inside. Think about the story, for example, of the three little pigs. I'll huff and I'll puff and I'll blow your house down. The moral there is work hard and it'll pay off. The boy who cried wolf. The moral there is don't lie. And so most stories are actually like Trojan horses. There's something hidden inside. Let me give you one more example of what I mean. So imagine you didn't know me, and we met tonight. And while we're waiting for the talk to start, I came up to you and I said, hey, did you know that Subway has 5 subs under 5 grams of fat? Did you know that? What would you do? Probably look at me like I was crazy, right? Why did you just walk up to me and tell me that Subway has 5 subs under 5 grams of fat? But many of you have probably heard this story of a guy named Jared. So this is a story of a guy. He was in college. He was very overweight. He's about 400 pounds. He picked his courses not based on what he wanted to take, but which ones had the largest seats and which ones were easy to drive up to in his car so he didn't have to walk. His roommate at the time was a nurse. He said, Jared, you're really overweight. You're obese. You're going to have diabetes and heart problems and other sorts of things. You've got to lose weight. So Jared goes on a Subway diet, lives near Subway. He eats his regular breakfast, so if you want to try this at home, eats his regular breakfast, and then he goes to Subway for lunch and dinner. Every day, he goes Monday, he goes Tuesday, he tries it a week, then he tries it 2 weeks, he goes a month, he goes 2 months, he goes 3 months, he goes 6 months. Eventually, he loses about 180 pounds by eating Subway, the Subway diet. He goes from pant size, I think something like a 56 to more like a 34 or 38, what most of us are, all by eating Subway sandwiches. Now, if you think about it, that's a pretty impressive story, losing that much weight, eating a fast food diet. But did you notice what was hidden inside that story? What did you learn about Subway along the way while I was telling that story? What did you say?
Subway has no nutritional value.
Touche. Somebody else, what did you learn about Subway? Healthy, low fat, you can lose weight eating it. Do they only have one healthy option? They probably have a couple, right? You must be able to eat there for months on end and not get bored. All the stuff that's here is hidden inside this story. This is what I'll call a Trojan horse story. It's a narrative that has an outside candy shell. We don't tell it because we want to advertise for Subway. We tell it because it's a remarkable story. This guy lost all this weight by eating Subway sandwiches. But Subway, the brand, comes along for the ride. We learn information about them because it's inside this story. It's hidden inside. And so you need to think about building a Trojan horse story. And there are other great examples of this. So Will It Blend, that video I showed you at the beginning, is a perfect example of the Trojan horse. Think about what you learned about that blender. What did you learn about the blender? Really powerful, which is exactly the message that they want you to realize as a consumer. You're sharing it not because you want to advertise a blender company. No one wants to advertise a blender company, let me tell you. But you shared it because it's remarkable content, but the blender came along for the ride. The benefit came along for the ride because it's a Trojan horse. Let me show you one more example. It's for a company. Unfortunately, it's not cheese made from panda milk. That would be truly remarkable. It's an Egyptian company named Panda, and they make cheese. And I want to show you a couple of their ads. Can I make you a cheese sandwich? No, I'm not hungry.
No one.
Never say no to Panda. I'm going to show you a couple. Good morning, good morning. I got you Panda cheese for breakfast. No thanks, I don't feel well.
You know why.
Never say no to Panda. Dad, why don't we get some Panda cheese? Enough, that's too much already.
Just you know why.
Panda. And last but not least, Daddy, why don't we get some panda?
Just you know why.
Get one. Get one more. So this video is great. It's really funny. I hope you watch it. I hope you share it with your friends, and I hope you talk about it as a thing you enjoyed from this evening. But I want to point out two things about this video. First, it's very funny. And indeed, our research shows that humor, more humor leads to more sharing. That's not super surprising. We see a lot of that on YouTube. But it actually also explains why angry things are shared, why angry political rants are shared. Both of them are high arousal emotions. They're emotions that activate us, that fire us up, rather than deactivate us. So emotions that are high arousal get us to share. But notice that this ad would have been equally funny if it was any guy in a suit, if it was a guy in an alligator suit or a cat suit, or if it was for Joe's Used Cars. Come down to Joe's Used Cars, you'll get crazy prices, right? You've all heard those ads. It's a really good example, though, because it's a perfect Trojan horse for the Panda Cheese brand. I challenge you to tell someone else about this ad without mentioning the word panda, which is exactly the brand that they want you to remember. They've designed a perfect Trojan horse. They've made sure to put their brand as an integral detail behind that narrative. It's like the murder weapon in a murder mystery, right? You have to remember the weapon because it's a key detail in the story. And so it's not just about creating crazy, crafty content. It's about putting things inside so that the brand or the benefit comes along for the ride. So just to wrap up, we talked about how word of mouth drives things to catch on, drives things to become popular. But to make it work, you need to understand what makes some things talkable rather than others, why people talk about some things. And as we've talked about today, it's not luck, and it's not random, and it's not chance. There's a science behind why some things go viral. Right? We can predict what's going to be popular, and we can craft contagious content ourselves. We talked about six key steps, things like social currency, that hidden bar, please don't tell, and BlendTech, right, which figured out a way to make blenders remarkable. We talked about Rebecca Black and why Friday is more popular on Fridays because it's triggered by the environment. We talked briefly about emotions and how when we care, we share. We talked about public things, how Apple had an ingenious idea to make those headphones white, make it easier for people to see. We didn't talk about practical value. We read about it in the book. It's all about useful information. And finally, stories as Trojan horses, things that carry information or brands or anecdotes along for the ride. Thank you guys very much, and I think we have a few minutes for questions.
Okay, I would like to remind our audience listening at home, this is the Commonwealth Club of California. My name is Kevin O'Malley. I'm chairman of the Business and Leadership Forum here at the club and your host for tonight. Our program tonight, Jonah Berger, speaking on why things catch on. And we do have time for one or two questions, so I'd like to turn it over, and we'll bring you the mic.
I'm curious how you build a statistically robust database if 93% of what you're studying might be just anecdotal and untraceable.
So we actually have good data on offline word of mouth. So we've done things like the New York Times investigation. We looked at online content. We've also done things, so the Keller Fay Group, which is the group I talked about before, has a bunch of offline data, diary data about what people talk about. There's another company called BuzzAgent that we've worked with that also tracks offline word of mouth. And so we've done these analyses as well, and we find the same principles. So you're very right that offline word of mouth is harder to track, right? Indeed, people talk about dark social. Even some things online are hard to track. Things like email, for example. If they mention a brand in email, it's not really tracked. But there are some companies out there that have tracked offline word of mouth. If you're interested, there's also a fun app. It's called the EAR, the Electronically Activated Recorder. And you can actually record what you talk about throughout the day. It basically is a digital listening device. Be a little bit careful because I don't know what the two-party recording laws are here. We almost got in a little bit of trouble in Pennsylvania. There, if you record someone else without their knowledge, you can be arrested. So we decided to skip that. But depending on what the laws are in California, it may be something you might want to play around with. Yeah.
You mentioned six steps, and so I'm just wondering, are things more likely to go viral if they hit more than one of those, or is it just about getting one of those really well?
That is a great question. So I like talking about this in terms of a Cobb salad. So everyone probably knows a Cobb salad. It's delicious. It's one of my favorite things to order when I go out to eat. It's got all the veggies, but it also has great toppings, right? It's got the cheese, and it's got the bacon, and the ham or the chicken, and the eggs, and the tomatoes. Is a Cobb salad better if all those things are there? Yes, it does taste better. Is it terrible if only five of the six things are there? No, it's still pretty good. And so like any other recipe, the more of these you can include in your message, the more likely it is to be talked about and shared, online or offline. But if you can't include all of them, that's okay. But I think if you notice, the companies that do best at this, they actually work on the ones that are the hardest. So sometimes you might say, I'm working on something that's really naturally emotional. I'll just do that. That's easy. And it's almost like by working on things that are hard, Google has a great ad, for example, that really pulls on the heartstrings for something that's not a very emotional product. And so it's really about pulling hard and figuring out how you can make it work. By the way, if there's any entrepreneurs in the audience, we have some downloadable content on the website, a free resource to help apply these ideas, a workbook. And it talks about how to work through some of these ideas and really figure out how to make content that will be more talkable or shareable.
Okay, we have time for one or maybe two more questions.
You briefly mentioned the small statistic using Facebook and Twitter, but knowing how much social media is a part of our culture now, how much do you see of that influencing on how things do catch on?
So I think more word of mouth as we move forward will be online, definitely more than 7%. I think people are surprised. By the way, if you're surprised by that number, just keep a tally throughout the day of what you'll talk about. You'll be amazed at how many things you talk about and share. You're not actively necessarily recommending things, but you're still talking about them. You may say, where should we go to lunch? This place or that place? Which will remind people that restaurant exists and encourage them to go there in the future. So even if it's not, even if we don't think it's a lot as offline, it actually is. I think, though, there are some differences between offline and online that we've looked at. So, for example, online communication or any written communication actually encourages us to engage in more self-presentation. We talk about more interesting things, for example, when we share online because we have more time to think about what to say. You ever notice in oral conversation, someone says something, and then you want to say something back pretty quickly because you don't want to sit there in silence. It's embarrassing. It's awkward. But then you don't have the time to think about the most interesting thing to say. You just talk about whatever top of mind. Whereas in written communication, you have time to edit. So I have a friend who talks about this, and he says, you know, he's really swapped by girls when he text messages them. And then they meet him, and they're really disappointed, right? And that's because when they meet him face-to-face, he doesn't have the time to craft that message. And so I think when we move to online communication, it does shape what we share a little bit, definitely. Yeah.
How is your research on talkability informed increased sales? So, for instance, in the Will It Blend,
yep.
Do they really sell more blenders, or do we just talk about more about their blenders?
So sales actually, you picked an easy one for me. That was a softball. So sales went up 750%. And that's partially because no one talks about blenders. Right? No one naturally talks about blenders. But if you wonder, like, how did we, for example, take advantage of the ideas in building the book? So I have a couple of you lucky folks. I only brought four of them with me. But we made some tissues, some orange tissues that say, don't you wish your idea was as contagious on them? And mention the book. Because it's cold and flu season, and we want people to connect. All that sneezing go on. It's a frequent trigger in the environment. Make them think of this contagious book. We made the cover orange, for example, because we wanted to make it more publicly observable. So if you see someone reading it, you say, oh, what is that? I want to find out more. And so these things definitely increase sales in a host of contexts. So one more. Yeah.
So which aspect of the model is least certain or maybe needs more exploration in terms of what you're researching now? Or?
Yeah. So most of my research, we've done a lot of work on triggers, a lot of work on emotion, social currency as well, practical value, public. I think stories is an interesting one. One thing people often ask is, okay, stories work, but how do I tell a good story? And that's one thing I as an academic have had to learn. Academics are not very good storytellers. Right? We tend to be boring and dry. Half of you may have come here expecting to fall asleep while I was talking, and hopefully a little less than half of you did. Hopefully I kept a couple of you awake. But you're used to academics not being good storytellers. Stories are really engaging. If you tune in for the beginning and you can get people with that hook, they want to find out what happens at the end. Even if it's not a very exciting story, they want to know what happened. You know, how did you solve that problem? You know, where did you end up going that evening? How did the night end? And so being a good storyteller, I think, is an important thing that we don't necessarily know enough about. Thank you guys very much. I hope you enjoy it. I will stay after to sign any and all books, and I'm happy to chat as well. Thanks for coming.
Okay, thank you for all for being here tonight at the Commonwealth Club of California. Our speaker tonight was Jonah Berger, Why Things Catch On. With that, I'd like to thank our audience here at the Commonwealth Club and our audience listening at home for tonight's program at the Commonwealth Club, celebrating over 100 years of enlightened public discussion.